West at 18, gusting to 31, 71 degrees Kenosha, 70 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. As I look back over my many years of hosting the morning show and of conducting literally thousands of interviews, one of the most memorable has to be the interview I recorded a number of years ago with William Cope Moyers, author of the best-selling memoir called Broken. It told the story of William C. Moyers' battle with addiction and the slow and painstaking and sometimes torturous path back towards recovery, which he was able to achieve. And it became a source of tremendous illumination and inspiration for all kinds of people across the country, including plenty of people for whom this was a very difficult, painful reality, or maybe a reality for someone they loved or were concerned about. And for many of the rest of us, blessed not to have this to be part of our lives or of anyone in our immediate circle, it was eye-opening to come to a better understanding of what it means to be caught in the vice of addiction. I am so privileged to be speaking once again today with William C. Moyers, this time about his newest book, which in a sense explores the next chapter in his journey of recovery. And a painful chapter it is at many, many turns. The book is titled Broken Open. And the reason for our conversation is not just to talk about this fascinating book, but also because William C. Moyers is going to be coming to southeastern Wisconsin as the keynote speaker for the 15th annual Help and Hope Conference on Substance Use Disorders, which will be taking place on November 1st. And I believe it is the night before the conference that he will be signing copies of his new book at Blue House Books in downtown Kenosha. I feel privileged indeed to be able to reconnect with William C. Moyers to talk about this latest book, Broken Open, What Painkillers Taught Me About Life and Recovery, which is published by Hazelton Publishing. William C. Moyers is Vice President of Public Affairs and Community Relations for the Hazelton Betty Ford Foundation. William Moyers, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Greg, thank you so much for giving me another opportunity to be on your program and to reach your critical audience there in southeast Wisconsin. I know that there are many families who know firsthand the power of addiction, but I know, thanks to you and Guida Brown and others, that there are many families in that communities that, you know, also know the power of recovery and the fact that there is hope for people who struggle with substance use disorders.
Right. You have it's not only a beautifully written book, but at the outset is a beautifully written foreword by none other than Roseanne Cash. And I want to ask you about the way in which she opens that foreword with these words: "This is not a redemption story. This is not even a singular story of addiction and recovery." I imagine you agree with those words, or I don't think you'd have them in the pages of your book. And even though, you know, you're not Roseanne Cash, perhaps you have a pretty good idea of what is behind those words, that this is not a redemption story. That is this new book, Broken Open.
That's right. And Roseanne Cash, the daughter of Johnny Cash, she's a dear friend of mine. We've had many of the similar experiences that many families have shared when it comes to these topics. I did ask her to write the foreword, and to my pleasant surprise, she did. Not only did she write the foreword, but she clearly read the book. She's a very busy woman in her own right as a singer and performer, songwriter, touring the country. But she took the time to read the book, and she's right. This is not a redemption story. It is not a redemption story, and it's not a singular story of, you know, addiction and redemption. It is a complicated story, as she says, and that's exactly what my journey is. I think my journey is what many of us have experienced. The longer we're at it, the more challenging, Greg, recovery can be for some of us or for many of us. I really liked what you said in your open about the fact that this book is about the next chapter of my life. Some people have said, well, William, it seems like you were living a double life during those 3 years that you struggled with pain medication while still being an advocate for Hazel and Betty Ford. And I was kind of taken aback, Greg, by that sort of description that I was leading a double life. I didn't see it that way. I saw that I was living the next chapter of my life because I was a man in long-term recovery from addiction to crack cocaine and alcohol. I love my recovery. I owe my life to my recovery, and my advocacy work at Hazel and Betty Ford depends on my recovery. But for 3 years, between about 2012 and 2015, I struggled with a baffling inability to just say no to narcotic pain medication that was appropriately prescribed for a dental procedure that developed into chronic pain. So after I finally found the solution to that problem, during which those 3 years I was not open about it, I was filled with shame that I could not quiet my craving brain in the ways that I had quieted my craving brain in the past when it came to alcohol or cocaine. But this time with the opiates, I could not quiet that brain with my faith. I could not quiet my brain with my recovery program, my 12-step recovery program. I could not quiet my craving brain, even though the stakes were pretty high that I needed to. When I finally quieted that brain with an anti-craving medication, an FDA-approved medication, I decided I needed to write about this experience because I owe it to my constituency, I owe it to families, to help them understand that recovery is not a destination. For me, it's a journey, and this journey has high highs and it has low lows. And while my first memoir, Broken, was a story of addiction and redemption, I went down, I hit bottom, and I went back up, the rest of my story, all those years, all those decades since I wrote Broken, were, as I said, filled with high highs and low lows, including that struggle with the pain meds. And I needed to write that book because I needed people to understand, as I said, that recovery is a journey, it's not a destination, but that for me, what I discovered along the way, Greg, and I think this is the important part, what I discovered along the way is that for me, a man in long-term recovery, there is more to my recovery than sobriety. Sobriety is a good thing. It's important for a lot of us. But when we're dealing with the chronic disease of addiction, it may not always be sustainable. It may not always be consecutive. And that's certainly what happened to me. So that's why this new book, as Roseanne says, is not a singular story of addiction and redemption. It's a complicated story of a complicated man. And that's because I'm human, because I have a chronic disease, and because, again, for me, recovery is a journey, not a destination, and has not always included sobriety.
Right. As a matter of fact, towards the very end of the book, you talk about three terms that I think a lot of the rest of us tend to be very sloppy in using or thinking about. Those three terms are abstinence, sobriety, and recovery. And you say recovery is bigger than both abstinence and sobriety. And I think what you're suggesting is that we really make a mistake of oversimplification when we consider all three of those terms as essentially equal, when in fact they're not.
That's exactly right. And thank you. Clearly, you read the whole book, too, because just like Roseanne, she captured the essence of my journey in her foreword, and you have captured it by noting that important section at the back of the book. Yes, you know, listen, once upon a time, I was addicted to, you know, as I said, crack cocaine and alcohol. It destroyed my life. I needed to stop using those substances, and I needed 4 treatments over 5 years, including twice, by the way, at Hazelden in Minnesota. I needed 4 treatments over 5 years before I learned to manage my chronic illness, before I picked up those tools, took responsibility, and worked my program of recovery. And I had a heck of a streak, you know, as I chronicled and broken. I had a heck of a streak. I remained sober for decades, and not using mood and mind altering substances. But as is wont to happen with a chronic disease, mine came back. My illness came back by way of those pain meds. And it was through that experience that I learned that addiction is cunning, baffling, powerful, and patient. It waits. But I also learned through that experience that I don't have to throw everything away. I don't have to give up everything if I have a recurrence of use. That when my chronic illness came back, I could still hold on to those things that really matter to me. In this case, my recovery, those things that make me a better father, a better spouse, a better citizen, a better employee. I could hold on to those things, even though I could not hold on to the sobriety that had been the definition of my success, frankly, for so long. So yes, for me, there is more to sobriety than abstinence, but also for me, there is more to recovery than sobriety. You nailed it in how you identified that as an important aspect of my key messages.
We're speaking with William C. Moyers, talking about his latest memoir, which is called Broken Up. It is a book that chronicles essentially the next chapter in William Moyers' life, following that which is chronicled in his best-selling book, Broken. In Broken Open, we find out about the many painful difficulties which he has confronted and dealt with in various ways, sometimes in some self-destructive ways, over the course of the last few years, as he contended with, among other things, addiction to opioid pain medication. One thing that you explore at the outset of your book, or close to the outset of the book, after kind of recounting some of the events of your first book, Broken, is you talk about the disintegration of your marriage. And first of all, I'm sure this had to be, I mean, I'm sure a lot of this book was difficult to write in terms of reliving some painful moments from your past, but I should think it was especially challenging to write about this, because, of course, for one thing, you're not just writing about yourself, but you are also writing about your first wife and about her own vulnerability and frailties and personal demons, if you will. And also what happened to your 3 children, and the way in which your family life, which for a while had, at least from the outside, appeared to be so idyllic, just came apart at the seams in a way that was really, really sad. Tell us about the experience of kind of not only living through this, but reflecting back on this, and why you thought it was important to share so openly about this in this story. I guess another way to ask that is, in what way was this a really important component in what ultimately befell you?
Yeah, thank you for paying attention to those other aspects of my story, Greg, not just the opioid pain use, but all those things that happened to me when I was stone cold sober. and had to experience them. You know what I've learned along my journey, and I've been on this journey of recovery from addiction since 1989. So I've lived more than half of my life, 35 years. I'm 65 years old. I've lived more than half of my life on this rocky road of recovery since 1989. And what I was to discover long before the pain meds became an issue was that, you know, the only thing more difficult than living life sober is living life drunk or stoned. So if you take away the drunk and the stone piece, life is hard. I mean, life is hard for all of us, whether we're in Wisconsin, Minnesota, black, white, Hispanic, Republican, Democrat, whatever it is, life is challenging. It's particularly challenging for those of us who are addicted to substances because we use substances to heighten the highs and mitigate the lows. You take away those substances and then we can't do that anymore. And we have to sort of live life on life's terms. And that's hard for all of us, but it's particularly hard for those of us who don't like to do that. And long before my run-in with the pain meds, I did experience my own failings as a human being, my own failings as a man, my own failings as a husband. I did experience the destructive nature of my then wife Allison's mental illness, which she allowed me to write about in the book. I experienced a divorce that taught me about the pain of heartbreak experienced sober. Wow. I had to go through what it's like to be left as a single dad of three busy teenagers. I had to go through what it was like when those teenagers grew up and began to experiment in their own way with substances. So this book is as much about life on life's terms as it is about the opioid pain meds. And I wrote that, and it was important for me to write that because I needed to emphasize to people on this journey, whether they're 30 days in or 35 years in, that it's okay to think that life is hard. It's okay to struggle in recovery. It's okay, if it happens, to have a recurrence of use. That was important for me because I've been a beacon of hope for people for many, many years. I've worked for Hazel and Betty Ford for 28 years, and I've used my own story to try to smash stigma and promote access to treatment. But what I've experienced, Greg, is as I share my story, I became a beacon of hope for people who need help. You know, as you pointed out, I'm going to be speaking there in southeastern Wisconsin on November the 1st, and I have no doubt that people who hear me speak that day will come to some of them will come to me and ask for help. So I had to write this book because I have been using my story in my role as an advocate, and that's why this story is not, as Roseanne says, a singular story of addiction and redemption. It's a story of a complicated man in complicated times. So. I had to write about it. I was sensitive to my now ex-wife. I was sensitive to my own children. There's some detail that's not in, it's some detail that was those experiences that are not in my book because I, you know, it's my memoir, but it's their lives too. But I was very fortunate that almost everybody who is part of my story, part of my journey, I was very fortunate that they allowed me to share those interactions that we had along the way because it just shows me to be more human and thus it shows me to be more relatable to the reader.
Very good. And I really do appreciate the way in which you write about this part of your story in a way that is revealing and yet I suppose not too revealing. I mean, I think you are respectful and sensitive and at the same time acknowledging the complexity of what you experienced. At one point you write, in the intricacies of a long relationship between two people, what breaks can never be fully restored. And you say over and over, we were seared by flashes of pain and disappointed by too many mirages masquerading as hope. I mean, I think a lot of people will read those words and will be able to understand. I also appreciate the fact that you take a little time to talk about the swirl of attention that you experienced with the publication of Broken, which, of course, did indeed become a New York Times bestseller. And I appreciate you saying that, because that's also important for us to understand the all of the glamorous trappings that are part of being on, you know, Good Morning America and so on, as well as the humbling moments when six people show up for your first book signing at a huge store in New York City. I mean, it can be exhausting and exhilarating and sometimes disappointing and so on, but it really helps us understand where you were in life at this point when this next chapter begins. And I think it's safe to say that that's a really essential component of why, you know, when these new difficulties arose, you didn't necessarily feel like you could be fully honest and open about them with anybody else and even yourself.
Thank you for catching that. You're right. And you know, Broken, my first memoir, which, as you said, was a New York Times bestseller. It's in its fourth printing. It's still in print 19 years later. I had to live into that story. You know, I had to live up to that story. I had to, you know, people loved that book. They were inspired by that book. It helped them. It set the tone for their own decision to ask for help and to stay the course of their own journeys. But that book is a snapshot in time, right? I mean, it was written in 2005, came out 2006, and here it is 19 years later. Tried to live up to that book, and that was really, really hard, particularly when big chunks of my life were falling apart. You know, several people would often say to me, "Oh, you know, Moyers, we want to be like you one day." And I was like, "Be careful what you ask for. You don't know my whole story." And you know, what's so interesting, too, is that in the literature of recovery, particularly in the 12-step program of recovery, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's got a lot of stories in there. But none of those stories really are about the rest of the journey. They're about what it was like, what happened, and then how somebody got better. It doesn't sort of dive deeper into the rest of our journeys. That's why this new book, 19 years later, is relevant, because it does dive into the rest of my book. And one of the things, Greg, I think it reveals too, is the pressure of performing, the pressure of always living up to what people read, what people want, what people expect, the pressure of, well, of trying to be as good as I can be, even when I can't be good. And that's always been my MO. Those pressures, the pressure of heartache, the pressure of divorce, the pressure of raising children, all those things, they did build up. And like a dam, they were held back for a long time. But as I write in 2012, 2013, when those pain meds entered my life, they suddenly were an opportunity for relief. You know, I can take the edge off the pressure. I can not have to try so hard. And that's why, you know, the dam ultimately burst and all that flotsam and jetsam sort of surged downstream and sort of swept me along. I was very fortunate, for reasons that I detail in the book, that I could keep my head above water, but it was a really, really tough time. And I think one of the lessons of the book is that people like us, particularly those of us in recovery, we have to be vigilant. We have to take care of ourselves. We have to make sure that we tend to the bodies of our mind, tend to the garden of our mind, body, and spirit.
Right. Well, and certainly you disavow us of the notion that one can be cured once and for all of an issue like this. I mean, even when one is securely in recovery, that does not mean that the door is shut on this really dark possibility. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with William Cope Moyers about his newest book, Broken Open. We are speaking today with William Moyers because he will be coming to southeastern Wisconsin to be speaking at a conference on the 1st of November on the Racine campus of Gateway Technical College, the 15th annual Help and Hope Conference on Substance Use Disorders. William Cope Moyers, in his latest book, talks about the painful painful addiction which he developed for pain medications, specifically opioids, which of course has been a pernicious destructive presence all across the country in staggering numbers. For you, this seems to have begun most directly from an encounter in the dentist's office. And one of the reasons you had some really, really serious issues, some very serious things wrong with your mouth, with your teeth, which required some extensive work. And it was really from there that a lot of this new pain developed. Explain briefly, first of all, that sort of situation that made it necessary to seek some really extensive dental work, and then what ensued in the dentist's office that set you on this next chapter.
Well, I am like a lot of your listeners. I'm getting older. And as we get older, stuff happens to our bodies. And in my case, my mouth began to break down. My chronic drug use in the late 70s and early and 80s, my chronic drug use, my type A personality, some sort of, I don't know how to describe them, but unaddressed dental issues from the past that suddenly became more complicated as I got older. All those things led me into the dentist chair. I mean, I've been in the dentist chair plenty of times in recovery, but this time it was for some significant surgery. And I, as a result of that surgery, I developed a neuralgia in my jaw, which ultimately was about chronic pain. And so that's what happened. In hindsight being what it is, you know, I'm like a lot of other people in recovery. I need to be very vigilant about the use of any mood or mind altering substances, even if when they are appropriately prescribed by dentists and doctors. In this case, by dentists and doctors who thought they knew who I was. I mean, I'm a public advocate for the issues around addiction treatment and recovery. I don't have any secrets in that way. And the people who were treating me knew that. And we all assumed, and this is nobody's fault here. There was a little bit of ignorance. There was a little bit of assumption. There was a lot of hope and trust that, you know, this would all work out. But I was prescribed medications, these opiate pain meds, because I had legitimate pain. Nobody should suffer. I should have been more vigilant about it. I was living alone at that time, so I didn't have anybody that I could have given the meds to dole out to me. I'm sure I could have if I'd been more deliberate about it, but I thought it would be okay. You know, I've been in recovery for decades, and as I said earlier, I love recovery. I don't want to lose my – I don't want to walk away from that. I owe everything to it. But yeah, I had that surgery, and it just cascaded downhill from there. I liked the pain meds. They worked. They worked for more than the pain. They sort of took the edge off of life after that really, really tough stretch I'd had. And then suddenly, Greg, I discovered I couldn't get off of them. As I said earlier, I just – all those tools that I had in my toolbox, I couldn't – they didn't work because – you know, there's a popular phrase in recovery, which is a drug is a drug is a drug. But when it comes to opiates, that's not true. Opiates are a beast unto themselves. I call them the Trojan horse of addiction in America. That's why we have an opioid epidemic in Wisconsin, why we have an opioid epidemic in Illinois, in Minnesota, in all 50 states. Those pain meds are something. Hmm. Those opiates are really, really a drug that doctors and dentists don't understand, and patients and others can't get on top of. And here I was, somebody with decades of recovery who could not quiet that craving brain. So that's how that whole time unfolded. I didn't start using opiate pain pills because I wanted to throw away my recovery. I didn't start using them because I wanted to check out of life. I didn't start using them because, I loved them, although I did like what they did to me. I started using them for pain, and I could not stop using them because I have a vulnerable brain, and because opiates are opiates. They play with that brain in a way that no other drug does that I'm aware of.
Right. You know, as I read your memoir, I felt myself almost experiencing a little bit of stress as I read your vivid description of what this felt like when you really first took those pain meds back home and what you experienced. I'm just going to read a little bit of this. You've taken these pain meds. You're kind of waiting for them to take effect, and then you say, after a few minutes, something changed. I felt as though someone had gently drawn a thin, warm blanket over me. I opened my eyes and looked around. Had somebody followed me up the stairs? I closed my eyes again and smiled. Now it felt like waves of relief were lightly washing over my whole body. The throbbing from my swollen jaw, aching gums, sore muscles, and stiff neck faded. I could feel the pain evaporate, picturing tender wisps rising from my body and so on. I felt happy, content, complete. I was smiling again. And I'm reading those words and just thinking, in fact, I feel badly that I read them out loud because I keep thinking, what does it feel like for you to relive a moment like that? I mean, in a sense, is that a moment of acute temptation for you? And I especially wonder, what was it like to relive that crucial moment in the sense of writing about it so vividly, about exactly what you experienced and why it was so pleasurable for you?
Good question. No one's ever asked me that, and I've done a lot of media interviews this fall. Hearing you read it doesn't tempt me. Hearing you read it reminds me that, it reminds me that good journalism depends on interviewers who read the books of the people they're about to interview. So thank you for diving into it that way, Greg. There was nothing good about those times. It's the lessons that I've learned coming out of those experiences that have been good. What I've probably, I don't want to say I'm most proud of it, but what I have come to appreciate is that this old man Moyers is still teachable, and that I can still learn from experiences such as the one you just read. I can be a good student when it comes to those things that are going to help me further along my way. I am still teachable. And I think this book really reflects, because remember, it took me 6 years to write this book. I started writing this book in 2018. It didn't come out until September of 24. So it took me a long time to sort of evolve those experiences into the relatable story that you just shared. It's one vignette of it. I think that really does reflect that all the things I've learned along my way, all those things, the good things, the hard things, the bad things, the rewarding things, the experiences of life, all of those things have gone into what I talk about is my 35-year recovery journey. Again, not being sober all that time, but being teachable along the journey that defines my recovery. I think that is what a real lesson of this book is. One of the sort of the subtitle of the book, Broken Open, is What Painkillers Taught Me About Life and Recovery. And I think that is really the essence of this memoir. What painkillers taught me about my life and my recovery. And so again, whether it's the moment the pain meds washed over me, the moment I couldn't quiet the craving brain, the moment I had to experience heartache over a divorce I didn't want, all of those things have been those teachable moments that have led me to this moment, and for that I'm grateful.
Right. One of the things that's really interesting in your book, and of course you're a wonderful writer, and you really know how to use words, and in a sense, you're also somebody like a lot of us who knows how to misuse words, in the sense that you would, and you talk about this, about very consciously steering around certain words, or using words in such a way that might slightly disguise the seriousness of what was befalling you. I mean, for instance, the matter of taking plus one, that is taking one more pain pill than was prescribed, and somehow, you know, plus one somehow made that seem like not that big a deal in the moment, and yet of course it was a very, very big deal. And later on, when you do attend an AA meeting, and you do stand up and speak, and to some extent you're honest, you say, I had a run-in with pain meds. I like the feeling, but it scared me. It is such a relief to be here tonight. This is where I need to be. I know it. But you use the word run-in, and you say, I did not use the word relapse. I couldn't bear to utter it. It's so interesting to think about all that is wrapped up in that moment, and what that moment might have represented if in that moment you had managed to say the word relapse to yourself and to those listening to you. But I think it's really interesting to think about the way in which we choose words, the way in which we frame an experience that can have so much to do with what we think about it and what we do about it, how we act upon it.
Amen. Greg, the language of this field, it needs to be more nuanced. We need to be more thoughtful in the words we use to describe an addict or an alcoholic or somebody who is clean now that they're sober, or even the word, what does recovery mean? I mean, and certainly the word relapse, that is a shaming word. It often is used to suggest that the person who's had a recurrence of use has failed, that they have not worked their program. Remember, there's a very popular phrase in recovery: it works if you work it, but you got to work it. Well, I was working my program of recovery. I've been working it for decades. So what happened to me, yes, I could have been more vigilant, but what happened to me is I had a flare-up. I had a recurrence of my illness. And the language does matter. And candidly, Greg, I'll tell you that for me, this was not a relapse in the way I had always understood relapse. Now, people are going to take issue with that. I understand that. But remember, I've been in continuous remission for my addiction to cocaine and alcohol for 30 years now, since October 12th of 1994. I've been in continuous remission for my use of cocaine and alcohol, the two drugs that always took me down. So to suggest that I relapsed, to me, was not what this was about, because I didn't go back to the crack house. I didn't go to the bar. I wanted my recovery. I had a recurrence of use that came from the virulency of my illness. Mm. And by the way, I just have to, am I parsing words? I don't think so. I work in the field, and it's really important that our field of addiction treatment and recovery support, that we really give serious thought to how we use the language to describe these things. I also just need to say, and I appreciate you giving me credit for being a, quote, wonderful writer. And I am a good writer. I was a newspaper journalist in the 80s, and I learned who, what, where, when, why, and how of journalism and how to write those things. And I've carried that with me for 40-some-odd years now. It has been a real asset to be a communicator. But I also, this book really benefited from a colleague of mine at Hazelwood Publishing. His name is Mark Olson. He was the editor of this book. I call him the creative editor of this book. And he has as much to do with what this book is and how this story is told. He has as much to do with it as I do. And while I love you giving me credit, I got to give Mark some credit too.
It's interesting what you were saying too about how we can, you know, leap towards generalizations and simplifications and so on, when often the story is more complicated than that. And that's part of the story of this versus something else that you talk about, that sometimes when we choose certain words, you call them the self-justifying and deceptive tools of an addict. And of course, that's where those that are around us can make such a difference in terms of listening to us honestly and openly and so on. As you write your book with a great eye for detail, and of course you kept a journal through this whole period and quote extensively from it and so on, and ultimately you do seek help, and that help comes in a lot of different ways from a lot of different people. One of the things that is interesting, speaking again of words, is that as you sought help and received help from different people, one phrase that would kind of come up more than once, and sort of, I suppose, couched in the what we think of as tough love, is when people would say, you of all people.
Sure.
Yeah, when they would say, as talking about, just kind of assessing what you had done this long, years and years of deception in order to get all of these prescriptions one after another from different, and then, for people to say, you of all people, should have understood this and so on. And you write candidly about getting really tired about hearing that phrase, for as much as you might understand why people might say it. But it speaks to also a source of difficulty in all of this, and that is who you were, your impeccable reputation, your great success, the way in which you were an inspiration to others. That made this then such a source of shame for you. And much of this book is about you grappling with the reality of shame and of finally deciding not to allow that sense of shame to direct what was going to happen to you. But I think that's such an important lesson for so many of us who grapple with shame in various ways. It can be such a powerful force.
Yes. I don't know of anybody who is immune to the toxicity of shame. I think all humans have it in one way, shape, or form. When you are somebody like me who has a brain that's vulnerable to substances, i.e. a person with an addiction, shame can be fatal. If you're somebody with mental illness, shame can be fatal. And coming to terms with that shame means confronting the truth, because a lot of shame is grounded in some sort of truth. It may not be a truth that you like. You may be the victim of sexual abuse, but it's still the truth. You may not want to be an addict and an alcoholic, but that's still the truth. My shame came from the sense that I needed to be better than what people expected of me. Especially once I found sustainable recovery in 1994 and got a job at Hazelden 2 years later, and I'm off to the races as a public advocate, and I'm talking about the fact that treatment works and recovery is possible. Well, when I was struggling with the pain meds, suddenly those key messages, suddenly my persona, my reputation was in jeopardy, until I realized that, wait a minute, I'm human, just like everybody else. I can't be perfect. Just like everybody else who has a chronic disease, that disease can come back, whether it's cancer, diabetes, depression, addiction. So Moyers, just be who you are. Just lean into this story. I mean, Mark Olson, my editor, always told me that, Broken was a story I had to live up to, and Broken Open is a story that I get to lean or live into. And when I leaned into my reality, when I leaned into the truth that even somebody of my stature, my reputation, my profession, even I, when I suffer a recurrence of use, when I have to grapple again with shame, hey, you know what? That's okay too. I mean, as long as I go and get help for it and get back on my road of well-being. And then for me, when I do those things and then write a book that shows others that it's okay too.
In our closing couple of minutes, I want to give you a chance to talk about a very harsh reality and that is that for all of the people who suffer from various kinds of addiction, and particularly what we are talking about in Broken Open, that the number of people who actually either seek out treatment or are able to secure retreatment is just a tiny fraction of those who are suffering this kind of misery. And part of the message of your book is a call to arms, that we simply must find a way to make effective treatment more available to a wider swath of the public who so desperately need it.
Yes, yes. That's always been my mantra, if you will. That's always been a key element to the foundation of my platform for my public advocacy. I've always said addiction does not discriminate, and neither should recovery. We at Hazel and Betty Ford, we know that the number one public health crisis in Wisconsin and in Minnesota and in this country is addiction. You can also include mental illness in there too. We've begun to embrace that reality, that most of the people we treat at Hazel and Betty Ford come to us with mental health issues and substance use issues. So there's not enough access to treatment for people who need and deserve help for a substance use disorder or a mental health condition. I believe that more now than ever before, and I've always believed it with the conviction of my own heart and soul. Whether it's lack of financial resources, whether it's a lack of insurance coverage, although that has gotten better, whether that's the shame and the stigma, whether that's the war on drugs that continues to be misguided, even though it has gotten better, we still wage a war that's too much about locking people up and not holding them accountable by giving them treatment, the carrot and stick approach, if you will. All of those things have come to inform my public policy. And that's why I think a tenet of my message, and actually why this conference, which is titled Help and Hope, Agueda Brown is just a great champion for what you and I are talking about. She's a great champion in this country, but she lives there in your neck of the woods, so to speak. This conference is called the Help and Hope Conference. I've spoken at it before, and help and hope are the essence of my life's journey, my life's story. They are the essence, help and hope, to my public advocacy. And this book, I always want people to feel empowered to ask for help. I've always said it's okay to ask for help. Overcome that personal shame, overcome that public stigma, and ask for help. And when people ask for that help, it is, we owe it, we as a society, we as a healthcare system, we as states like Wisconsin, we owe it to our people who live there and are trying to get better. Those people who ask for help, we owe it to them to give them the help that they deserve. Hmm. So my public advocacy is all around the fact that it is okay to ask for help, and that when people ask for help, it is imperative that we as society give them the help that they need and deserve, they and their families.
William Cope Moyers is the author of Broken Open. He will be the keynote speaker for the 15th Annual Help and Hope Conference on Substance Use Disorders on November 1st, and signing copies of Broken Open at the Blue House Bookstore in downtown Kenosha the night before. William C. Moyers, thank you so much for being my morning show guest today. I was honored to speak with you. Very, very best wishes to you.
Greg, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to carry my message of help and hope to your audience today.
And if you're interested in hearing my previous two conversations with William C. Moyers, check out the podcast version of The Morning Show, and on this past Sunday's edition, that is October 27th, you can hear my first two conversations with William Cope Moyers. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Herschel Cougar from the theater faculty at Carthage talks about their next theatrical production, a new play called Life Cycle of a Star. It is the next installment in Carthage's highly acclaimed new play initiative. And the playwright, Ali Viterbi, will join us as well. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show. Today's going to be a mostly sunny, windy day with a high of 83 degrees. Our winds will be gusting up to 40 miles per hour. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake.